Our sun is headed into solar maximum, the period of greatest activity in its solar cycle. My name is Troy Klein, and welcome to the new podcast series called Space Weather Living History. During this series, you'll hear directly from the people who for years have been studying the evolution of space weather, how we make observations, and our capabilities to predict space weather events. Now, every 11 years on average, our sun reaches a peak period of activity called solar maximum. That's followed a few years later by a period of quiet called solar minimum. During solar maximum, there are many sunspots, solar flares, and coronal mass ejections, all of which can affect communications and technology here on Earth. Now, the energy from those solar blasts can disrupt radio communications, upset electrical power systems, damage satellites and change their orbits, cause navigational equipment to make mistakes, and even endanger astronauts walking in space. The effects from these solar storms can be far-reaching. In fact, they can have impacts throughout our entire solar system. These conditions are what we refer to as space weather. Sound exciting? Let's get right to the next interview.
Mauricio Peredo, and I work for Science Systems and Applications. I've been doing work with NASA Goddard for 23 years now, and I was part of the International Solar Terrestrial Physics Program, ISTP for short. That was one of the first programs to get into what's now known as space weather. The primary areas that I worked on that were related to space weather was magnetospheric physics, where I was involved with a group here at Goddard that was modeling the magnetic field inside the magnetosphere. But also I did some work modeling some of the boundaries of geospace, in particular the magnetopause and the bow shock, generating three-dimensional models of those and how they move in response to changes in the solar wind. I had the good fortune of getting on the ground floor when space weather really kind of took off. Here at Goddard, they established the Science Planning Office for the ISTP, that's the International Solar Terrestrial Physics Program, and I was the head of that office, and we essentially were the first project that attempted to look at the Sun-Earth connection in a global sense as a system of interconnected parts. The Science Planning Office did the coordination of all the measurements and analysis of the data from not only the NASA satellites that were part of the ISTP program, but also a large number of international and ground-based and theory elements that all came together to try to study the whole propagation of disturbances from the sun all the way to the Earth environment and how they created phenomena like the aurora and some of the disruptions of the magnetic environment near the Earth. I think one of the things that was really exciting is that prior to ISTP, there had been a few missions that had attempted to do, you know, multi-satellite observations with two, or in a few cases, maybe three satellites. But ISTP was really the first time that we attempted to look at these with a fleet of satellites. So it was like, if you go back, 80 to 100 years in time, it would have been like trying to predict the weather in New York by having observations from, you know, a handful of stations in Texas and Kansas and, you know, Alabama, and trying to do that and figure out what was going to happen in New York. Here, for the first time, we had satellites spanning the different areas of space around the Earth and trying to put them all together to predict what was going to happen. It was also the first time that these various science communities really started to work together. You had solar physicists with magnetospheric physicists, with ionospheric physicists that historically didn't interact a whole lot, all of a sudden together in one room trying to compare their data, trying to help piece together how something that was propagating affected what their instrument was seeing. So it was a pretty exciting time to be part of that. And it was really interesting to see all the personalities and because of the international nature of the program, there were participants from many different countries. And so you had to not only get through the science exchanges, but also some of the cultural differences and the customs. I remember, for example, going to Germany to represent the project at a meeting, and there were about 40 participants. not one of which was an English native speaker. I was representing the U.S. The English representative wasn't able to attend, yet the meeting was held in English because it was the only common language. So this, you know, has a pretty interesting human aspect too. I joined the project in around 1990, 1991. And essentially my first job was to stand up the science planning office. And then I, you know, continued my involvement with the program for about 10, 12 years. It was a CME, and there had been a failure of a communication satellite around the time. And there's a lot of speculation as to whether the CME had, you know, being the cause of the effect. Of course, we didn't have access to any of the data from the communication satellite, so we couldn't really establish that cause and relationship, but we were able to document what the impact was to the environment near Earth, and then made that data available to, you know, the owner of the communication satellite to maybe help them in, you know, in better trying to assess the, you know, what possible impact they might have had. Certainly, the electronics in satellites are susceptible to discharges and to, you know, the electronics can get damaged. Well, I think certainly that event in April of 97 was one, because it was really the first time that we had an event that generated enough interest that it was covered worldwide, and we had enough coverage to kind of put together a movie, if you wish, of how the event propagated from the sun through interplanetary space and then impacted the Earth's magnetosphere. I think it brought to the attention the need for continuous coverage. Oftentimes we have, you know, a single satellite in a particular region, and that's really not enough. Many of these phenomena are interconnected, and what's happening in one region affects what happens in another. And if you have single points, you have an incomplete picture. So I think ISTP was really the first example of just how much better you could do if you had a fleet of, you know, a dozen, maybe 20 spacecraft. And then, of course, if instead of having a dozen, you could have 100, you could do even, you know, maybe 100 times better, just like the weather models progressed over the years. And of course, the more sensors you have, the better the models can get, and then the better the predictions can get. So mm-hmm. I think ISTP is sort of in the adolescent phase, you know, that we've gotten past the initial stage where you've proven the concept, but really to take it to the next level, you really need a much larger fleet of spacecraft. You know, they have to collaborate, and it's not trivial. You have to agree on, you know, what data you're gonna collect, at what time resolution, on what format, so that you can easily compare. You know, if you're taking your data every 2 minutes on the odd number minutes, and I'm taking mine on the even number minutes, then when we try to compare, you know, we have to adjust to the fact that we're not synchronized. Well, similarly, when you're talking about several tens of instrument with not just temporal but spatial and geometric effects, you have to get everybody to play together and to agree how they're going to share their information so that you can make sense out of it. And, you know, the more pieces you have, the more important that coordination is. Well, I first joined the program at the request of Mario Acuña, who was the project scientist for NASA for the ISTP program. And Mario was originally from Argentina, and I'm originally from Mexico. So he and I actually shared many of the stories in Spanish, and often talked to the media and to school audiences in Spanish. But one of the other exciting things about ISTP was that it was one of the first times that there was a concerted effort to reach out to the public. And there were several scientists associated with the various missions that were very actively engaged in kind of sharing that knowledge. On the SOHO spacecraft, Art Poland and Barbara Thompson gave a lot of the background and the information on the solar missions. On the geospace missions, Nikki Fox and myself, and later on we hired an outreach specialist, Mike Karlowitz. And so we kind of formed this little group of folks that would go out and talk to the media and talk to schools and kind of try to explain the science of space weather and how it propagated and what some of the impacts were. And we worked closely with some of the scientists at NASA headquarters, for example, Bob Carovellano and George Withrow were very supportive of helping us get the message out.
I hope you enjoyed the Space Weather Living History podcast brought to you by NASA's Sun Earth Days program. You can learn more about the Space Weather Living History Project on our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov. And don't forget to join our growing community of Facebook and Twitter fans for the latest information and facts about the new Sun Earth Day themes. For all other details about these programs, including information about our past Sun Earth Days themes, be sure to visit our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov.
This is Troy Klein signing off.